Hey, you are listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson. Welcome back. Welcome back. So this is the Media Roundtable. And on today's lineup, we have a beautiful guest, of a beautiful group of panelists. I have got my man, Jack Webb. How are you, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being in. We've got Nikisha Williams, writer and Jacksonville Today contributor.
Happy Friday, y'all.
Dan Scanlon, reporter for Jacksonville Today.
I am here.
And one of my favorites, Claire Goforth. Claire is my favorite because she brings me gifts. Thank you, Claire.
Just the once, but maybe if you're good, you'll get another gift.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm going to keep asking for another gift like this one because she gave me a sticker, y'all. It's a great sticker. I feel like I need another one. So we've got a full day today, a lot to talk about. Randy DeFore's withdrawal from the general counsel consideration, the partial collapse of a parking garage in Riverside, the Jacksonville homicide rate, and the Jacksonville Jaguars' first regular season home game against the Kansas City Chiefs. We are going to dive into all of that, but we would love for you to join the conversation. Call us right now at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air. First Coast Connect to WJCT.org, and you can find us on Facebook and on Instagram. Feel free, join in, tune in. Okay, so let's talk about this. Wednesday, Mayor Donna Deegan's appointee, Randy DeFore, withdrew her request for consent from the city's general counsel. Her nomination has been the source of heightened contention among city council members as the September 26 vote neared. Now, the city council is back to square one, trying to fill the role of general counsel. And Jack Webb, being that you were a former president of the city council, let's go to you first. What do you think about all this?
It is the hot seat. Yeah, interesting. At the outset, this whole issue of the lobbying restriction, I think, was a red herring. All right, that's a nothing. It's a non-issue. It came down to whether or not, whether it's politics or it's qualifications. I don't know. But the council president said, listen, we're going to vote this thing. It was obvious that Mr. Ford did not have the votes. So rather than fall on the political sword, let's withdraw it. Let's move on. Now, okay, it begs the question, you know, what are they going to do in the interim? You know, again, will there be another interim? There will be another interim. And what's the process going forward for the selection of a new general counsel? It needs to be filled. But we can get more into that. But here's the real question in my mind. All right, so right now the Deegan administration is 0-2 with Republican appointees, so much for bipartisanship. All right. This will lay bare the true intentions of the city council with regards to the Anna Brochet nomination. When she comes up for consideration by the rules committee for the full council as whether or not she is qualified to be the CFO of the city. And that's a big issue because not only did Anna Brochet, as a Republican, back Donna Deegan, she also had the temerity to run against Lenny Curry 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. So where is the council going to go? Is it politics? Give her a fair hearing. If they don't, I think it's really going to cast some aspersion on the council's motives.
Who are the major players in the effort to thwart DeFore from taking this position?
There are seven. Nick Howland is the leader of it. Kevin Carrico, a few others. Their names are escaping me. I'd have to look it up. But they're, you know, Republicans, allies of Lenny Curry. And I do find it interesting that the same types of people who 8 years ago when Curry came into office would have been going on about mayoral vision. And it's really important for the mayor to be able to appoint the people that they want. Now we have a female Democrat mayor. And they're like, well, just a minute, little lady. I don't think you should appoint these Republicans. And I mean, everybody knows that the reason for this and has nothing to do with qualifications. It really comes down to the fact that they opposed Daniel Davis in the mayoral election. That's really what this is about.
The Ethics Commission request and then the decision to vote before the Ethics Commission's opinion, I don't know, it just adds more firepower to the idea that this is all politics as usual.
Well, some might say it was efficiency. Let's get this done and let's get ourselves a general counsel to get the process moving. But on the other hand, correct. You do it before there's an opinion that tells you whether or not it's righteous to do this under state standards. And my other question is, whatever happened to qualifications? Al Ferraro, certainly our general counsel candidate, certainly seemed to have the chops, even if there was no degree for Al, to get those jobs done. But obviously, politics is jumping in, and we, the citizens, now are interim in those positions.
Mayor Deegan stated that this is political and not ethical, and DeFore was the subject of a smear campaign. And I think everything that we've been pointing to now, it seems that the mayor has something to stand on when she's saying that.
I mean, she has something to stand on before she said it, just with the way that she came in as mayor, defeating a heavily backed, supposed, you know, Republican appointee, even though we have elections. And I think a lot of people who are in the city council who were very loyal to the previous administration and the previous mayor have a problem with that. And so now it's about exerting power. Who is going to have the power in the city? Is it going to be the city council or is it going to be the mayor? It's a lot of chest thumping right now of people trying to exert who has control. And if there's a coalition on the city council that is willing to constrain this mayor, then they are going to do that. And then in 4 years say, well, she didn't do anything. She didn't have a vision. She didn't have a plan. She wasn't able to get anything passed. She's bad for our city. And they're going to back somebody else in the next 4 years. It is absolutely political. And it just makes the city suffer because you are putting power over people.
Yeah. Do we think that DeFore could end up in another position in the Deegan administration?
Yeah, most likely, very possibly. If she'd want to be in City Hall after this, that's her call. As she said herself, she could make a lot more money in private sector than she can in City Hall. But she seems to me to be a person that really, that sees the value of public service. So I could see that. But again, to the extent that it comes up before the council, it might be problematic. it's interesting. I understand where the council's coming from. I really, because I'm a former president of the city council. Council's co-equal branch of government. I get that. You're going to have tensions between the executive branch and the legislative branch. It's inevitable, and it's good to a certain extent.
It's actually good, right?
But ultimately, I remember when I was city council president the year before as vice president, we went through a very, very contentious budget cycle. The city was tearing itself apart, and Mayor Payton and I met right after I got elected. Said, John, we're not doing this again. I will not do this. And we put together a very, very sound finance committee. We worked cooperatively. We got it done. We had our differences. We worked with the JSO. We worked through all of the staff budgets, and we got a budget done. Now, it was not well accepted by the community, but it was the right thing to do. I think that's where the council needs to go at this point.
That was a very different time, though, politically in America and in Jacksonville. I mean, and also, like, to just be fair and push back a little bit, you know, that was two Republicans. There wasn't this Republican schism that we see right now when you've got somebody like a Randy DeFore going against several of the council members, right?
You make a good point, Al, but it's interesting because it was the very early stages of that cancer that took over the Republican Party. I mean, and by the way, you ask any Republican out there, they'll tell you Webb's a rhino in any event. So put that aside. But seriously, it was when it was like this partisanship that had taken over D.C. started to permeate and kind of manifest itself on a local level, and it made absolutely no sense. But that was when that's when it was starting.
Yeah, you look like a human, not a rhino to me. But I would say the question I have then is, like, how do we go forward? The next big one, and correct me if I'm wrong, the next big nomination or the biggest one to come before the city council is going to be Anna Brochet. Like, how do we see that playing out? Because she definitely ruffled some feathers on the Republican side, even though she is a Republican.
Well, just a little quickie here. The 26th, meeting of the 26th, Ron Senlum, the president, asked for it to start 2 hours earlier. It will start at 3:00 on that Tuesday because of certain items that are on there. And the general counsel's office says certain other items that people expect to see at 5:00, 6:00 have to remain where they are, quasi-judicial, things like that. Mm-hmm. But because of budget items and things like that, it's starting earlier. And I've been here for 40 years. I don't ever remember a council meeting being pushed earlier to give 2 more hours. So it's going to be a busy night. And I think that portends a busy summer and fall.
If they succeed in blocking all of the mayor's nominations, where does that leave us as a city? How do we move forward from that?
I mean, we'll have key offices that are left vacant or with interims. Mm-hmm. That's going to be problematic for cohesion and for continuity as we move forward. Are we going to see the next 2 years just be characterized by gridlock and council standing in the way of everything that Mayor Deegan tries to accomplish? It's one thing to have a good faith effort to negotiate, like Jack Webb was just discussing with the budget discussions earlier and when he was on council. But it's another thing to just say, well, you know what? You know, inside of themselves to be like, well, you know, she's a Democrat and these Republicans supported her. And so we're just going to throw every roadblock that we can in her way and waste everyone's time, quite frankly. I mean, sure, we'll all get bylines out of it, right? We'll get some talking points. But in the at the end of the day, are you doing this for the good of the city? Are you doing it because you really want to be an obstructionist and show your loyalty, your fealty to your allies?
And to that point, Lisa from Facebook says, people voted for the mayor for a reason. They agreed with her positive vision for the city. This is overt obstruction. Certain CMR, in her humble opinion, corrupt. Mm. Yeah, so you know, people definitely have feelings about this. Jack, I'm curious from the point of view of governance, and you used to be a city council member and mm-hmm. president. If the city council is set to obstruct the mayor's agenda, how can the mayor get around that?
Bully pulpit number one, I would say that. Number two, she's gonna have to adjust. They're gonna have to be some sort of detente declared where. You may want to engage members of the civic council, of the business community, the non-electeds, as we call them, who exert influence citywide, region-wide, and get people in a room and try to try to negotiate some sort of process for moving forward. That's the way it used to be. I mean, that's the way, you know, you get... That's the way it was at one point. As far as moving forward with an agenda, I would, again, there are a lot of things that she can do without council approval, with by and through her different departments. Again, with regards to infrastructure improvements and things of that nature, that is not something she would necessarily need to go before the council to execute on, assuming that the budget's passed and she has the requisite funding. But it's interesting to see where it in fact does go over the next couple of weeks. It's going to be I would just hope that, you know, the leadership is going to have to say, hey, people, you know, put your guns back in your holsters. Here's one of the things I was thinking. I won't hog the mic, but this is one of the downsides to term limits. These guys who are on the council right now, right? They're not, they realize they're out in 4 years, 8 years. Well, I was out in 4 years because I term limited myself. But, you know, ordinarily you get reelected, you're 8 years, and you want to go to the legislature. And then you're going to go to the legislature. I mean, you want to go to the Senate, right? And so every election cycle, you know, you are being scrutinized by your primary voters as to how you voted in your prior position. So, again, you're not going to buck the party because you won't get the support from the party. That's right. Just one of the issues we face. That's our political reality.
I'm Al Letson. You're listening to First Coast Connect, and this is the Friday Media Roundtable. You can call us at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air, First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. You know the routine. Join in, talk to us. We want to hear from you. So Tuesday afternoon, a portion of the top floor of a three-story parking garage at Ascension St. Vincent's Riverside on King Street collapsed, damaging several cars. Luckily, no one was injured. So this same builder, Baston Cook, was the lead in another parking garage that collapsed in Atlanta, Georgia in September of 2020. They defend their work, saying it passed safety inspections in 2007 at the time it was built. Thoughts on who may be responsible?
Well, it's a single slab that went down, and it came down at one end, so it could be any number of issues, and we won't know. Inspectors haven't gotten out there. The city told me the other day, after I'd been out there, and thankfully found that no one had been injured, just people sort of scared stiff in the stairwells that had to be let out by police, is that the property owner's responsibility is to maintain the structure. During construction of those parking garages, the city does inspect it, but once that's done, it is up to, in this case, Ascension St. Vincent's to inspect, and I believe there hasn't been one in a while. The other issue in Atlanta from the same company, some workers were injured. Apparently, Best & Cook did have a statement this week saying they stand by their work, and so far, St. Vincent's has only said that, the investigation is underway. But I'll tell you, driving out there, Al, guys, I was scared stiff. In my mind, I'm thinking condo tower collapse in Miami. I'm thinking the 2007 collapse of the Berkman parking garage that killed a worker, and wondering, what am I going to find when I got out there? And then, thankfully, it was just a lot of investigation. Everybody got out. But I talked to one guy who was in the doctor's office right next door, and it's connected to the parking garage. Yeah. They share walls. He said they heard a bang. They went out, and this thing had gone down. And all he can think of, because it was 9/12, was 9/11. He'd watched it on TV the night before as the World Trade Center has collapsed, and all he could think of was the collapse of another building.
Yeah, it's scary. That hospital is in my neighborhood. That actually, I remember that parking garage specifically because my son was born in that, my youngest was born in that hospital, and that's where we parked. or where I parked. It's scary to think that the buildings that are all around us, if something went wrong or there wasn't an inspection, that something like this could just happen, like a nature, clearly something went wrong somewhere along the line.
And is the building code to blame here? I mean, for years, developers have basically had their way with the building code. You know, Jacksonville caters to the interest of the developers. You look around town, you see the clear lot development, you see these homes getting thrown up, these condos getting thrown up made of ticky-tacky and particle board. That parking garage was finished in, 16 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I live in a home that is 60-some years old, and you know, it's never collapsed on me. And I feel like if it collapsed, then there's got to be a reason that's not just, well, who knows, let's just pass the buck around until everybody forgets. There's something
and
went wrong.
The city also told me this, that once once the people do the inspection, the city does not require a copy of that. So there are no copies of the inspections that have been done past or post construction.
I think this is a bigger issue than anyone really thought about at this point. I mean, this is a project the administration, the city council could work on together, because there is, Claire, you were asking about, was it built, was it an inspection, standards issue at the time of construction? Probably not, because when they certify and they sign off on the building in 2005 or the structure in 2005, it's fine. Okay, great. But there's no statutory scheme for any further inspection. I would assume that it's driven by insurance considerations. If you want the insurance or insurance building, you're going to have inspections to make certain it's structurally sound. But, okay, that didn't occur here. It's interesting because the legislature, after the collapse down at Sunrise, passed a statute that required annual inspections of condos, all right? So they did that. They recognized it was a problem. And then that year as well, New York City passed another ordinance of their own, Local Law 126, that required, and they based it on the condo collapse of South Florida, that was justification, to require annual inspections of parking garages. Now, you've got these garages that are open to the elements, okay? So you're getting water intrusion. You're going to get cracks in your concrete. It's gonna affect the rebar. So after time, you're going to have structural issues. So why wouldn't we? Let's do it as a city. Let's be a model for the rest of the country. Let's work on comprehensive legislation at the council level with the administration to provide for. And there are companies out there that do this all over the country, mm-hmm. that come in and provide these inspections. So you could get industry support for this easily, because Batts & Cook, who built it, they don't want to get sued. They don't want to get sued on this after they sign off a building in 2005. you know, so require that the owner of the the owner of the building or the structure have annual inspections. Makes sense to me.
Roads and bridges are open to the elements as well.
And our roads in Jacksonville are trash as well.
And our bridges, I mean, if you look at the bridge report, it is really alarming to know how many structural deficiencies there are in bridges. And this is, you know, to your point, Jack, an infrastructural issue across the
country. And a lot of those bridges right now are on a list of construction projects because of how bad they are.
Sure.
Yes.
And this isn't just a problem that affects Jacksonville. This is a problem throughout the
infrastructure in the country is horrible compared to other countries in the world, including the neighbor to our north, Canada. Like, you can, the difference is night and day. And I think there's a confluence of issues here with the parking garage collapse. It is absolutely could be a structural issue because of the erosion. We've had major hurricanes that have come through the city that really affected the Riverside area with lots of flooding, with lots of rain, with lots of wind damage. So that is a problem as well. But also, if it passed inspection in 2007 and it's been 16 years since it's last been inspected, if that's not the developer's fault, then that is the fault of the property owner, which would be the hospital. You just said your house is 60 years old and it's never collapsed on you, but I bet you also do maintenance on your house as well. If you catch a leak or you need a roof or anything happens, you go and get that done so that it doesn't fall on your head, so that the problems don't continue. So we have, there's blame to go around to everyone. It's an infrastructure issue. It's something that the city council can work on. It's something that the hospital should have been maintaining better. And it's something that the building code needs to be written in a way that it protects the people and the users who are going to use the facility. Buildings made of concrete should not just fall on your head. They just shouldn't. They should not fall out of the sky.
What's surprising to me is, given where Florida is with the insurance industry, and I can just say the many times that I have had to have my property inspected in order to keep my insurance, the fact that that St. Vincent's, Ascension St. Vincent's, and whoever insures them were not demanding these inspections be done. That just seems strange to me, because as a homeowner, I can tell you that, like, I've had like four different inspections like in the last 2 years. They did a site inspection and someone from the insurance company saw that trees were too close to my house. So I had to get those trees cut down. I had to yada, 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 all of this stuff. And so, like, me as just a homeowner who has to worry about that, and worry about keeping my insurance unless I do whatever they tell me I have to do, in a state where insurance is a thorny issue that the legislature doesn't seem to want to tackle, the fact that a major, you know, organization with major structures does not have to have inspections, it just seems like there's something out of whack there.
For what it's worth, though, we've only had two parking garage collapses in what, the past 20 years. So, and one of those was still under construction. So I'm guessing maybe somebody's doing something right somewhere.
Well, I think the collapse was with the Berkman. I think that's because the building sat vacant or sat idle or fallow for a number of years. So I think there was the problem. I don't know, but I would assume that there was a distinct possibility that there was structural compromise of it, despite the fact that it wasn't completed.
Although it was a worker that was killed, so they were still working on it.
Yeah.
Just the sheriff indicated to me that he was across the street when the Berkman went down, and he had major fears as he went to St. Vincent's this week as to what he was going to drive up on.
Yeah,
I'm sure. According to the Times Union, Jacksonville reached 100 homicides September 9th. The number is slightly lower than in previous years, but it's still not a good look. And this has been a problem in Jacksonville for as long as I can remember. I mean, when I was a young man, I'm going to go way back, we used to call Jacksonville the Bang'em because, you know, there was gunshots everywhere. There's violence in the streets. And it seems like, you know, it's just been a steady, for the most part, a steady incline over the years.
You know, and think about what's just happened in the past few days. Yesterday morning, a person driving by sees a car with bullet holes in it and finds a dead woman inside. We find out 2 days ago that a guy by the name of Ty Head is the one responsible for shooting the woman in the car, Paige Pringle, and Tara Baker, who was on a bicycle. And then the next day, ends up in Nashville and kills himself. And forensics, thankfully, were able to do matches on the shells between the two cases and determine who it was. It's just bizarre. And my phone buzzes all the time with ears alerts from the sheriff's office. It's person shot, most times in the leg, in the arm, non-life-threatening. But then you get the drive-by shooting, like the woman yesterday, or you get the child in the car killed or injured. And it's heart-wrenching. I've been doing this for 40 years, and it is no easier In fact, it's tougher now as a grandpa to write about this stuff.
Yeah, the random acts of violence that happen throughout Jacksonville are tragic and horrific. But also the gun violence epidemic that happens in certain neighborhoods in Jacksonville. I think that like what can happen in Jacksonville, because it is such a big city and because we're so spread out. I mean, like the great thing I love about Jacksonville is you can stay within city limits. You can go to a farm. You can go to an inner city. You can go to a beach, like all of that stuff. But I think that that great distance also kind of keeps us disconnected in a lot of ways. And if the violence is concentrated in certain parts of town, it's really easy for other parts of town to not pay attention to that violence, to not see the weight and what it carries, because you're not confronted with it.
You know, amen to that. I mean, you look at the numbers, right? Last year, I think what we hit this number, I guess the number we hit 100 on September 14th. Last year it was August 14th.
Yep.
And last year it's hitting predominantly Black communities. You know, last year it was 71% Black, 23 white. This year is 81 Black, 16 white. So it's just the numbers are getting worse. But it is, you know, it's hard because again, you talk to people down in certain areas of the city, and quite honestly, there is a disconnect.
Yeah.
They don't seem to understand. People don't seem to understand that we are one city and it affects us all. But, you know, what's frustrating as well is the lowest number was 86 back in 2011. 2011 would have been, what, the third year, effective year of the Jacksonville Journey that was passed in 2007, 2008, okay? So we invested as a community. We invested as a city. And you know what? Apparently it worked. But then a new administration comes in with a new council, and because it's not a dedicated funding source, it's subject to the whims of 10 votes at council time, votes go away, right? The support went away, and we're right back where we started.
But I've said it on this program before. I've said it in my columns. Excuse me. Crime, most often violent crime, is intra-racial, which means it'll be Black-on-Black crime, mm-hmm. White-on-white crime, whatever. But also, crime is not the only problem. There's it's a result of a bigger problem, which if we look at Jackson, when we look at where the murders are happening and where everything is happening, it's a result of poverty. And I will stand on this all the time. When you don't have resources, when you don't have basic necessities, you adopt a mentality of, I have to get it no matter what. And if there is someone standing in your way of getting whatever it is that you think you need to survive, you don't have the kind of empathy and compassion for that person's life because you're concerned about your own. So when you talk about the Jacksonville Journey that was then replaced by a new administration with the Kids Hope Alliance and the investment in the community and in community programs and prevention programs, and not just juvenile justice, I mean actual prevention programs that don't incarcerate children but actually work to rehabilitate and restore them. You can't do that without community support and community buy-in. And that means you have to be a member of the community. And again, you cannot police your way out of these problems. Ramping up the police force and ramping up the police budget does not address what's underlying the crime. And as we hit 100 homicides this year, and the number's only going to go up because we have more months left of the year before the year is over, we're still not addressing what the actual problem is. And that's what's going on in these neighborhoods. What is the breakdown? I'll never forget a few years ago when I was still working at the television station, a 7-year-old boy was murdered. And when JSO finished their investigation, they found that boy's murder, which was accidental friendly fire from some type of gang shooting, was connected to 5 other murders in the city, including that of a grandmother and of a couple that was murdered at a club on Easter Day. So when we think about crime, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. And there are larger issues at play. And so we've been talking about the mayoral administration, the city council, and the tensions there. Just as infrastructure is an issue for them to partner on and to better the city, working on poverty and crime and things that are endemic to neighborhoods that have been underfunded and under-resourced and been decimated by political willpower of one party or another in the name of power over people. These are opportunities for the city to actually come together. And what was the motto a few years ago? One city, one Jack, something like that. to actually do that and be that and to work together across the aisle to address the actual problems in the city instead of fighting over who's running the city. Why don't you run it together and make it better for the people who live here? Because this keeps happening. We've been over at over 100 homicides every year since 2011, and the police budget has only gotten bigger. So something's not working.
Right. It's you continue, like you see the numbers keep going up, and the what the conventional wisdom says is that we need more policing to handle this. But as we get more policing and we give more money to it, and also I think that, like, to be fair, we ask police departments all over the country, not just in Jacksonville, all over the country, we ask police departments to do everything. We ask them to come out and be mental health counselors. We ask them to come between domestic disputes. We ask them to stop crime. We ask them to do all these different things. And then when you look at this violent crime, what we're really asking them to respond to is, as Nikisha said, the foundation is poverty. The foundation is lack of investing in neighborhoods. I did a story once for Reveal. It was about the drug trade in Chicago. And we found that, like, in a part of Chicago where the drug trade was really heavy in this one area, the number one employer in that area was the drug trade.
Absolutely.
All of the industry had moved out of that area, and literally no one could get a job. And so what can you do?
You go work for the drug man. You go work for the kingpin. I'm from Chicago. I know the neighborhood that you're talking about. And while that's not as bad in Jacksonville, Jacksonville is still considered the murder capital of Florida. Yeah. That's not a good thing.
And yet we have kids. We have kids who have been tracked to being at the bottom rung of those drug organizations. They're the runners. And they, because life is cheap, as you said, you diss me, I diss you, you shoot me, my brother's going to shoot you in retribution, and it's a never-ending cycle. And unfortunately, that's been the way it's been since, I guess, the mafia and maybe the colonists even, but it's just,
since Cain and Abel.
And I've been covering this for 40 years in the city, and it is painful, painful, painful to do this. And when you think of the innocent victims, like a little girl killed in the front room of a house, protecting her younger sister in a drive-by shooting that was aimed at her uncle, you just can't wrap your head around how we can degenerate to that.
I mean, we would be remiss to talk about this without mentioning the effect mass incarceration has on Black communities in America. You know, you see the school to prison pipeline. All these people end up incarcerated for a long time. It tends to be Black men. If you look at the incarceration rate in Florida, it's so high for Black males and females. And you take all of these people who could be productive members of their communities, who are parents and grandparents and uncles, then they're not there to support these children, to be, you know, role models to these children, and they're left to their own devices.
We've got Daryl from St. Augustine on the phone. Daryl, how are you this morning?
I'm great, thank you. All of that, what you guys just said, was very appropriate, very well said, and you've got to deal with the poverty, you've got to deal with the employment. But I don't think that there's going to be any real movement on this until the American people have to look at the violence. We had response when we had to look at the George Floyd. We had response when people saw dead bodies coming back from Vietnam. When you start showing children or that little girl's body shot up and dead, the American people will not tolerate that. But we keep saying, oh, there was a drive-by shooting here, there was a murder there, none of it matters until you have to look at it. When they have to look at dead children in these schools and all of these things, then the American people will get behind a change. But they're not going to do it if we don't force them to look at the ugliness of all of it and that violence.
Daryl, thank you so much. I appreciate your comment. I would push back a little bit because I think that America does not look at, like, inner city violence. We don't want to see that. And, like, that can just stay in the inner city is kind of the way America looks at it. But when you think about gun violence in the country, like, we had what happened in Newtown, which, you know, killed so many young people that it was evident. Everybody saw it. And what happened in that, we didn't get any change in our gun laws at that point. We didn't get any change in the way, not politically, we didn't get any change. But what we did see is we saw figures like Alex Jones come into popularity based off of denying that it actually happened. And so, like, you know, which I think like points to something a little bit deeper than just saying like we should show it to him. I think what people like Alex Jones point to is that there's a sickness in this country. And there are people out there that spread that sickness, like Alex Jones.
But it's not just that it's sickness. And I would push back a lot, because just as we were talking locally about the council prefacing power over people, I think nationally we preface guns over people. There are over 400 million guns on the streets in the United States at this moment, when we have a population of 330 million people. That's 70 million more guns than there are people. And not all of them are obtained legally. And some of them that may be obtained legally are done through loopholes, as we saw with the August 26th shooting in Jacksonville that killed three people. That gun was obtained legally. The guns in Newtown and in Uvalde and in Columbine, we can run the names, we can run the numbers, we can talk about how much we've been seeing murder, death, and violence on our television screens for decades. And no one cares, because you preface the right to bear arms over the right to live.
And I have seen dead children. I've seen teenagers with bullet holes in their chest. It haunts me to this day. It literally does. And so I'm very glad now sometimes that the police keep us a block away from all this stuff.
And we're going to go to the phone. We've got Susan in Mandarin. Susan, how are you this morning?
Well, what y'all just said was really sad, but in gun violence and too many guns in the street is horrible. But my question was a different angle, kind of what Nikisha was talking about before, some of the other solutions. I was listening to the school board meeting, and they just got a big grant for restorative justice program, and it's only going to be in some of the schools, and I don't know if y'all know more about it, but maybe you could talk about it and see if you think it's a good solution. But so if some kid misbehaves and he has to be reported, or she, if, you know, it's a reportable offense. But then after that, they get the group together and talk about it, because it seems like that's part of our issues. I last time out talked to a woman that called in and said, "Why are you talking about race all the time?" And he just had such a great answer. And I thought, this is dialogue. We need to talk to one another. And is that a restorative justice? Like Nikisha said, we have to have empathy for one another. Thank you.
Susan, thank you so much. Nikisha?
So like restorative justice comes out of the school of thought of what we're calling modern day abolitionists. And so they're abolitionists against the prison industrial complex, as well as detention centers for immigrants. So when they talk about prison abolition, which was formerly had the moniker, you know, defund the police, it's not so much we're defunding, but we're looking at new ways to think about what to do when people commit crime that does not always include warehousing people in prisons, that, as Claire mentioned earlier, which is behind the prison industrial complexes, which incarcerates more often than not more Black men than any other race or gender in the country. So when we're talking about restorative justice, we're also talking about another topic called community care and protection, where you are able to hold the person who has committed an offense accountable without putting them into a criminal legal system that is only looking at the legal ramifications of what they did and not getting to the heart of why they did what they did. And so it's a model that is gaining traction among liberal progressive circles, but not everyone is on board with this. I think at a school level, especially when we think about the Graham Parks and the Maddie V's here, that are those like last stops before children are actually incarcerated within the juvenile justice system, this is an opportunity to see, can children who may be going down a wrong path are considered, you know, at risk, be taken into this program and rehabilitated or restored, or just giving another opportunity to not go in the direction that they're going. I think it has less traction when we get to adult crimes, because they tend to be more heinous. And so there's a lot of squabbling about what restorative justice looks like at all levels, but it is a conversation that is being had.
And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Bill in Orange Park.
Good morning. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I was just listening to your program, and you know, I'm from New Haven, Connecticut, and I know people want to hear that about Northerners, but the point is, when you look at communities, there's always a lot of money spent in redevelopment. You know, every so often, the city will come together and they'll put together a redevelopment plan. And it has an impact on the community, but New Haven, they took another direction. They had quite a few little neighborhoods in the New Haven area, and the crime rate was really high. But what they did, they paid attention to those areas and improved the quality of life for people in terms of housing, transportation, and things of that nature. So now, when you look at New Haven, you've got these circular areas around downtown, and downtown has become like the backyard for New Haven in terms of people congregating. And they really didn't have to do anything about development about downtown or redevelopment about downtown, because when businesses started to see the opportunity of the traffic coming through there, they came in themselves. The other issue, too, real quickly, is that
Keep it quick, buddy. Sorry, yeah, okay. We got to keep going.
Okay, go ahead.
No, go ahead. We got to keep going.
Okay, in order to have a decent quality life in a community, taxpayer dollars have to stay in a community. And we look and see what's going on today with cities, towns, and states. They're giving away tax credits to corporations to move into areas. But when you look at that process, is it really a fair return on the dollars? Because most of the people that work in Jacksonville don't live in Jacksonville. St. John's County, Clay County, Nassau County. Corporations today have a new way of operating. It's called outsourcing. So the entry-level positions, which really could help inner-city areas, are outsourced.
Yeah, Bill, we got to wrap it up, but I really appreciate your call. Panelists, any thoughts on what Bill had to say?
I mean, amen to that. I mean, I get it. One of the communities he failed to acknowledge or mention was Orange Park. So Bill from New Haven, welcome to the area. Move to Duval and help us out. But, I mean, amen, investment in the community makes sense. And that's what we've been talking about since consolidation, right? Invest in these neighborhoods.
Yeah. And we've got Jim in Riverside. Jim, how are you?
Hey, doing good. Thanks for taking the call. One of the problems that we have is the sheriff's office is established by the Constitution, and their primary role is to protect property. And here in our consolidated city, we're essentially using our sheriff's office as a municipal police department. And we think we're saving money, but really we're losing lives because we don't have the properly functioning municipal police department that we need for a city this size.
Jim, thanks so much for the call.
You know, at least there are some programs out there like Bishop Guns and Operation SOS that works with children in the Duval County school system for a decade now, and they are showing success. We don't really hear much about them. Police Athletic League is out there. The sheriff's office is hiring a few more mental health counselors to ride with officers to try to divert
to help
someone
them with
an
what,
issue.
The 50 hours of mental health training that they get.
Well,
I mean,
but there's a mental health. There's a mental health person in the car. I'll give them that much. There are some
they're trying.
New programs. Yeah. Little programs, and those programs are working. And, of course, let's not even forget the civil citation push that is working in other counties in Florida, but so far not accepted here.
I mean, that just goes to show that the problems are large and complex. They're not, you know, endemic or germane to Jacksonville. They're happening nationwide. And I think to Jack's point about development and the caller as well, is that one of the things that needs to be said when you talk about developing a community, you have to do it with the community. Mm-hmm. You cannot develop for the community or in name of the community and give them what you think they need. You have to do it with them so that you don't push them out of their homes.
Yeah. And at that, it's that time. Oh, I love it when a plan comes together. Thank you so much, Brady. It's the lightning round, and I'm going to start with my buddy Claire Goforth. What you got, Claire?
All right. Jacksonville versus Kansas City. All right. This is going to be really weird, but you guys, can we get Taylor Swift to break up with Travis Kelce before the game? Because I hear they're dating, and you know she's got a way of messing with a man's mind, and I would really like to see the Jaguars beat the Super Bowl champs.
I'm out, man. I don't know what to say. I just, like, that's a very insidious plan. You're going to wish this man heartbreak So you get the win.
Taylor, give him a bracelet that says it's over.
He said Taylor got that Badu. Okay.
Okay. With that, we're going to go to Nakisha.
I'm a week early, but next week is the Jacksonville Book Festival. It's coming back for the first time since February of 2020. I'm doing a panel on Friday the 22nd. They're doing a big promotional push, so everybody come down to the Jacksonville Book Festival. And if you see me on Friday at 10:30 in my publishing workshop, come say hi.
Boom, boom. Jack.
You know, I was going to talk about the UAW going on strike, but I just can't follow Taylor. I ain't going there, man. I want to be asked back to this program, okay?
And Dan.
For all those geeks out there, Ancient City Con this weekend in St. Augustine, all the sci-fi folks are down there. And then on a more serious note, on Tuesday, I'm in the big chair, and I've got Sheriff T.K. Waters. So I think of some questions for the sheriff of Duval County.
Yes, it's me. Hi. I'm the problem. It's me. So,
you get it.
I think I just outed myself as a Swiftie.
I think like, you did.
I'm a Swiftie and a Beyonce fan. Like I mean, what can I say? Hey, come on.
Annette can hire you then.
Yes, there we go. And that is our panel for the day. Everybody, thank you so much for coming in. Jack Webb, Dan Scanlon, Claire Goforth, and Nakisha Williams. We will be back after this break.
Of psychiatry. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me tomorrow at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It, only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
On the Independent 89.9 HD4, we're all about music discovery, playing new music from emerging artists and locals all day long. And on Sundays, we dig deep into a true American art form with legendary and emerging jazz artists on our Jazz Brunch. Then we go from Studio 4 here in Jacksonville to Studio 1 in Jamaica, where we start our journey through the best of 6 decades of reggae. Tune in on Sundays for Jazz Brunch from 10 a.m. to noon and Reggae Sunday from noon to 2 p.m., only on the Independent 89.9 HD4.
Star Credit Union, we believe in helping members reach their financial goals and building stronger communities. It's why we offer our members better rates and give back to the places we call home. ViStar Credit Union. Visit vistarcu.org/join.
Scenic Jacksonville presents the Great City Symposium, October 4th. A.G. Laffley, former CEO of Procter & Gamble, shares how he led the revitalization of downtown Cincinnati and the Sarasota Bay waterfront. Tickets at scenicjacksonville.com.
Auto workers prepare to walk off, Mitt Romney bows out, and in Washington, Elon Musk and the rest of the world's tech titans show up.
I think this meeting may go down in history as being very important for the future of civilization.
All the biggest stories from across the country on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. You're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, and it is Friday, y'all. It is Friday. Oh, my goodness. It's Friday. Please, somebody buy me a drink. The Jacksonville Symphony is back. It kicks off its 2023-24 season tonight with a community concert. Here with a sneak peek is none other than Courtney Lewis, musical director of the Jacksonville Symphony. Courtney, this is the first time I've met you. But
it's a great pleasure.
It's a great pleasure for me because I see your face like it's in the airport. Like, I'm like, that suave debonair man leads my symphony. It's amazing.
You've got to take a selfie with the picture.
We have to do it. We have to do it. So first off, how far in advance do you plan these concerts?
We tend to plan a year and a half to 2 years ahead of everything. Mm-hmm. Now, this weekend, we have the community concerts tonight and tomorrow night, which is one of my favorite times of the year because we invite the whole community for free into Jacoby Symphony Hall. But unfortunately for your listeners, those concerts are completely sold out tonight and tomorrow. So I'm very excited about 2 weekends from now, September 29th and 30th, when we open the classical season. That's really when we start with our serious programming. But I say serious, still lots of things for everybody to hear. And we're particularly excited about that weekend because alongside favorites by Beethoven and Schumann, we're giving the world premiere of a brand new organ concerto by the composer Lowell Lieberman.
Oh, wow.
Being performed by Grammy-winning organist Paul Jacobs, the first ever organist to win a Grammy.
Wow.
People might not know, but in Jacobi Symphony Hall, we have a beast of an organ.
Huge.
An absolutely incredible instrument. And there isn't a whole lot of music written for organ and orchestra. So we've made it one of our big priorities to commission as many composers as possible to write for this great instrument. So this is a really exciting time for people who haven't maybe heard the Jacksonville Symphony before to come and hear the orchestra and experience this tremendous instrument and the organ as well.
If you haven't been to the symphony, you are missing out. It is a jewel in this community. And just going into the Jacobi Halls, like it gives me chills. Like,
it's a very special building.
It's so special. And the musicians there, I'm such a symphony nut. I'm hitting you up for free tickets.
I'm joking.
I support the things that I love. Like, you should support WJCT during this pledge fund drive. But I support it. I love the symphony. So what else do you have coming up besides the show in September?
So we have lots of music. If you check on our website, you can see music. We play music for films. We play kids' concerts, education concerts, Symphony in 60 when we perform rush hour concerts on Thursday nights when you can come after work. Something that we're starting new this year is because we play so much new music now, people tend to think of classical music as being old. I'm very keen on classical music also being the music of today and commissioning today's composers. But sometimes people find it a little bit difficult to hear the music from today. So one of the things that we're going to do for the first time in a couple of weeks on September 27th is have a new music living composers seminar when me and a couple of the staff conductors and Lowell Lieberman, the composer of this organ concerto, are going to get together at Jacobi Symphony Hall and just play people some new music. Talk about the different styles and idioms that are different in new music from older classical music and try and remove some of the barriers from people hearing the music of today.
Yeah.
So to encourage you, that's a free event, September 27th at 6:30, led by me and a couple of the staff conductors. We'd love to hear you there to discuss the music of today and to open your ears to the new.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Like, as far as like new composers and the music of today, what's your favorite?
Thomas Adès, English composer.
I'm totally writing this
down.
Very
good friend of mine, and whose opera, The Exterminating Angel, I'm conducting at the Paris Opera in April.
Wow.
Adès, A-D-E-S.
Yes.
He's the top of my list.
And so for people who are not, like, I will admit to you that, like, I love classical music, but I don't know who I'm listening to. I mean, obviously, I know Beethoven. I know Bach. My personal favorite is Ravel.
Oh, I love Ravel.
Ravel is so good. He's my dude. Mm-hmm. But when I'm listening to like a station or whatever, like I'm not checking like, you know, who are the greats and all of that. I'm just enjoying it. What would you say is like a good entryway into classical music?
Coming to a concert.
Yeah.
Of course. So look, people have this notion about what classical music is.
Yep.
I've made it my mission here in Jacksonville to kind of try and change that. The Jacksonville Symphony is an organization that's open to absolutely everybody. You can come to a concert knowing nothing and just enjoy the experience. The best way to experience classical music is live. There's nothing like being in the room with a group of 80 to 100 musicians playing music. You feel it, you experience the audience reaction together, and you also then have a memory of the piece that's specific to you and your life. That's the way to do it. So check out our website, find a date that works for you. And please dismiss those notions you have about it being a symphony for your grandparents or for rich people or only for white people. None of these things are true. We want to welcome everybody to hear this great orchestra that we have right in our hometown.
I remember the first time I heard the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. This is many, 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 many moons ago. And I don't remember the music that was being played, but I came into Jacobi Hall. I sat in a chair and I remember like watching the percussion session begin and feeling like the wave of sound coming at me.
Yes.
And it was so amazing that I closed my eyes and like the music just kept hitting me and it to the point where it moved me to tears. But then I would like open my eyes and was like, you got to see this. Mm-hmm. Like I was getting wrapped up in like just going with it, but watching all of these musicians and watching the conductor, like I love watching conductors. I mean, obviously.
Right, you steal all my tricks.
Right on. So it's just such an amazing experience. But I think people just, you know, they tend to have this idea that it's, you know, it's for old folks. It's for, you know, this, it's for that. But really, it's for you. Because when I went to it, I walked out thinking that this is my symphony.
Yeah,
this is mine.
And, you know, I don't think necessarily everybody realizes how good the orchestra is here. You know, we have a really world-class symphony here, and it's only got better and better over the last couple of years. So it's really one of the highlights of things to do in Jacksonville. And if you haven't been, like I said, just step out of your comfort zone and you'll be really surprised.
Excellent. Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. I am such a fanboy. I'm taking a picture with this guy right now. You have been listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson. This is the weekend, so I want you guys to go out and enjoy it. And remember, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. And we will see you Monday morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.